gentleman scheduled to come and speak, and unfortunately he had some health issues that prevented him from being able to join us. And at the late hours of today, my friend Catherine was kind enough to agree to step in and share her experience, strength, and hope. Catherine is an April baby, so she'll be celebrating another year of sobriety here in April soon. She's a very active member of our fellowship. She sponsors a lot of the women that you've probably met as you go to meetings. And I think that you're going to find that she's got a great message of hope. So with that, let me go ahead and introduce you to Catherine.
Hi, I'm Catherine, and I am an alcoholic. Bill, what time do I stop speaking? Because I could keep everybody here all night.
Yeah. let's say right around 5 minutes to eight would be an ideal time, you can stop short or long of that.
Okay, no problem. Okay, again, I'm Catherine, and I am an alcoholic. Like Bill said, my sobriety date is April 3rd, 1995. I'm coming up on celebrating 25 years of sobriety. My home group is the Civic Center on Tuesday nights. I've been a group member of that for a very, very long time. So, I was just sitting here thinking, this is just freaking uncomfortable and really weird. When Bill asked me to do it, I don't know why, but my first thought was, I can't do a speaker meeting in front of a freaking computer, you know, because it just feels weird. But then I remembered that, you know, we go to any length, and I can remember early on in my sobriety doing a lot of things that made me uncomfortable. You know, I didn't want to do it because it just felt weird. So I was sitting here just thinking about, wow, we're just kind of entering into a new brave world, new world of recovery, and it's going to take some courage and some time to get used to doing this via computers. And for me, you know, I don't know about you guys, but when I get uncomfortable, I just want to shut down and say, nope, I'm not going to do it. So I'm really grateful, Bill, that you're pushing me and challenging me to do something that's not comfortable. And I'm grateful that I get to be here sober today. You know, when I first got sober, like I said, I'm coming up on 25 years. And when I first got sober, we didn't even have cell phones. You know, if this had happened when I was getting sober, we wouldn't have meetings at all. I mean, we would not have been able to, collectively come together, even in a way that's not even in person. And for me, I'm just sitting here being, even as uncomfortable as I am doing it this way, I'm just filled with gratitude that today I get to be sober and today I get to actually continue to participate with other members in the fellowship face to face, maybe not physically, but face to face, and still have these meetings. So today I am filled with gratitude that this is happening. I'll have to admit, I saw this meme and I loved it. And it says dog on one side and a dog on the other. One dog on this side is like all messed up. The hair is everywhere. He's in pajamas. He looks awful. And the other meme on this side, the dog's all decked out. He's got his glasses on, all dressed up. And I have to admit to you guys, I haven't been dressed in like days. And so when Bill said, do you want to come and do the meeting tonight? I was like, shoot, now I got to take a shower and get some clothes on. I actually have to get dressed. And that reminded me of that meme. You know, we've been getting to sit around and really just kind of take it easy and not have to worry about what other people, you know, may or may not see. So I got dressed up for you guys tonight. So thanks for getting me in the shower. Thanks for getting me into some nice like clothes other than my sweats. And I'm sure David's appreciating that a lot. You know, as far as my story, when I first started, a lot of people in this meeting, I was looking at all who's here, and a lot of you guys have heard my story. But I want to welcome the newcomers and welcome to the New Vision ladies. I'm really grateful that you were able to make it. From my understanding from Bill, this is the first one you guys have come to, and meetings are so important. And so I'm really glad that you're here. I'm really glad that anybody else that's new to AA is in this meeting tonight. And I hope you get to hear something here tonight that helps keep you coming back, the way I got to hear something when I first got here that helped keep me coming back. So what it was like for me was that when I was growing up, my family was military. My dad was a commander in the Army. He was a pilot. And we traveled everywhere. We didn't stay in one place very long. In fact, I grew up over in Germany, and we traveled around Europe quite a bit. Didn't come back to the States until, I think we moved over there before I was in the first grade, and I don't think we came back until, you know, like the summer between sixth and seventh grade. And so I was about 11 years old. And for me, it was a really big culture shock, because my parents, well, my mother particularly, for some reason, really loved the idea that we kind of engulfed ourselves into the culture of the Germans, the German culture, the European culture. And I've never lived on a military base, even in the States. We always lived off base. And so when I came back from Germany and moved here, it was really uncomfortable. By this time, at the age of 11, I was already uncomfortable. I was uncomfortable living in a foreign country, but I was just uncomfortable as a person. I like that word, dis-ease. I was at dis-ease my entire life. I never felt at ease. Never felt at ease in my family. You know, I never felt like I actually belonged anywhere. And so you add the different cultural kind of component to it. And when I moved back to the States, everybody just kind of assumed that I was American, which I was, but I had never been to like a McDonald's. We didn't have fast food over in Europe at that time. I had never been to, I didn't know a lot of the music. I dressed like a European. There's a different fashion style. So that just kind of heightened my feelings of feeling out of place. I already felt out of place. That just kind of made it worse. So in the summer of when I was 11, we met some people, you know, some kids in the neighborhood. They were a little older than I was. And they had some alcohol and some side dishes. And so they offered me to have some alcohol, and I did it at first because I wanted to fit in. And alcohol was always a part of my family. I didn't grow up in a drunken family, but alcohol certainly was around in my family at all times. And so I just thought, okay, fine. So I took a drink, and to this day, I will never forget that first drink that I had. I'll never forget how relaxed I felt, how much it just kind of gave me that feeling of ease, you know, that part about that ease and comfort that it talks about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was lacking inside myself. And alcohol produced that effect in me. It actually produced an effect that made me feel like, oh, I can do this thing called life. And from the get-go, you know, I didn't drink to have fun. I drank to get drunk. I drank to have an effect on how I was feeling and what I was thinking. And it gave me what I heard around the rooms when I first came in here, was that liquid courage. And it definitely gave me some courage that I was lacking in just being who I wanted to be. So it allowed me, in the beginning, it became a very good friend. It allowed me to be that person I had always dreamt of being. You know, I got to get a bunch of friends and felt comfortable, go to dances. You know, I joined the pom-pom team. You know, I don't think I ever would have done that before. And so this thing called alcohol really did do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And so for me, at the age of 11, I had what I considered, I found the solution to life. And so off I went. And I wasn't a fall down drunk. I didn't get in a lot of trouble at home. You know, my family being a military family, I think particularly, you know, we were very precisionized, and we had to do things a certain way, and certain things were expected. And I was a commander's daughter, so I had to look a certain way and talk a certain way. At least that was my perception. You know, I realistically don't know if that's what my parents were sitting there trying to give me the messages of, but I know my perception was that I felt like I needed to be a person that I didn't feel like I could live up to. So I was always trying to be perfect, and alcohol just tended to take away the edge for me to feel like it was okay not to be perfect. But because of the military family and because of this other lifestyle that I had with other friends and drinking and doing things that definitely were not part of what my family unit looked like, I wore this double mask. You know, I wore this, I was one person at home, I was a different person at school. And then even as I grew up, and in high school, I can remember I finally got to a place where I didn't even, with alcohol, feel like I fit in with anybody. And I wore like 10 different masks, and I became this chameleon, and I would go hang out with anybody, you know, in any group, and just behave and act whatever, you know, way that I needed to within whatever group I was in. And I totally started losing any kind of formulation of self-identity that I may have even had, which I didn't have a whole lot of at that time. And alcohol just kept being my solution to being okay with who I was. And so I started drinking at the age of 11, and I continued to drink all the way through until I got sober, and I got sober when I was 30. So I went through high school, and I went through college because college was expected when I was, you know, in my family. I felt fearful about going to college. I didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I belonged. I hated it. I didn't find anything fun about it. Because I just felt like a failure, and I didn't think it was something I was going to be able to achieve. Somehow I made it through, and I can remember then at that point going, now what do I do? And then I'm just pushed out into the world, and now I'm expected to make a living. And my concept of what adulthood looked like was that you get out and you buy a car, and that you get a job, and you earn a lot of money, you get married, you have a baby. And that to me is what adulthood looked like, and that to me is what I was supposed to be doing next. So that's what I did. I got married, I got a job, I bought my first car, and I bought a stick. And I didn't even know how to drive a stick shift. So I had to literally learn how to drive a stick shift. And I learned how to drive this car, and I bought my first car after I got my first job. And my goal was to get as high up in the company as I could, because a lot of my self-identity would come from being a workaholic. I became this workaholic, and I developed a lot of who I was as a person based on what I would achieve at work. And so I earned a lot of awards and got a lot of plaques, and I worked my way up in the corporation units. And by the end of my work career, from the age of whenever I graduated from college up till 30 when I lost my job, or 29, I had already gone through two different types of careers, and I had worked my way up in both. One was a financial career, and I ended up in Denver, and that's where I bottomed out. And I was a operations manager of a financial institution on the 17th floor in Denver, Colorado. And my other career that I had done, I had ended up, I think I was like 24 or something, and I had ended up being a marketing director for a regional shopping center in Southern California, where I was in charge of the entire marketing for an entire mall. How I did all of that while I was drinking is still beyond me, because I was that drinker that would drink every day. I didn't get drunk at first every day, but I drank every day because I needed to have some kind of relief every day. I needed to have something that would help me to feel okay in the world. And alcohol was the only thing I could find that would do that for me. And so in the beginning, I wasn't drinking in the morning, because my brain had already told me that, you know, drinking in the morning is something that people who don't have alcohol problems, they don't do that. So I avoided drinking in the morning. I also was like, people don't drink and drive. And so I would try to control my drinking by, I would drink before I get in the car, I would drink after I get out of the car. My brain would tell me that I'm not a drunk driver because I wasn't drinking in the car while I was driving. And that made sense to me. So I was doing all of these control type drinking things that helped me to justify and rationalize that I didn't have a drinking problem. When I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I still didn't even realize I had a drinking problem. But I went through my career, but in the meantime, although I succeeded in my work and my career, I didn't succeed in relationships. And in the end, I didn't succeed in my career either. But my relationship, I married and I had a child. I lost that husband, lost that child in the beginning. The courts didn't take my child away from me, but my ex-husband said, you know what, I'm going to take him, and if you don't clean your act up, I'm going to take you to court to take him. That was enough scare for me, you know. My son was 3 at the time. And so we got this divorce, and I was still trying to maintain my life. And all the while, and I was living in Denver, and all the while I was trying to maintain this life, I kept crossing those barriers that when I was a child, I had always said I would never do this, and then I would do that. And then I would say, okay, well, then that was all right because now I've done it and I got away with it and it was all right. And I was like, I'll never do this. So each time I would cross some kind of moral or value or something about it that I said I would never be that person, and I would cross it, and that would become an acceptable way of living for me. Until the end, when I was 29 years old and I was in financial ruins, I was drinking till 4 a.m., 5 a.m., getting a couple hours sleep, and then going back to work. And saying, you don't drink in the morning, Catherine, and you white knuckle it till noon because you don't drink in the morning. I was so scared of drinking in the morning, and I would drink till wee hours in the morning. I was so scared to drink and drive, but yet I would black out all the time while I was driving, forget where I'd left my car. But because I wasn't drinking in the car while I was driving, I had convinced myself I was okay. Things just progressively got worse. I was in financial ruins. I lost my job. I lost the marriage. I lost my home. And pretty much what I had lost by the age of 29 was my dignity, my self-respect. I was like maybe 95 pounds on a good day. My hair was falling out. I was really sickly and gaunt and insane. And when I lost my job and I was divorced, my mom, who lived here in California, here in Visalia, was begging me, like literally begging me, to come home to live with her to let her help me. And I kept saying, no, I don't need help. Because in my head, I just thought I could just manage this one more time. If I could just get my act together, if I can just pull myself together, I can work it out again. Because I'd been doing that for years. And, but this time it wasn't working. And all I was doing was, sitting in my apartment, not knowing what I was going to do for a living, having lost my relationship, and drinking. And I could remember like at 11 o'clock at night, I'd watch David Letterman and I was hardly eating either, except for I would drink and on a good day I'd eat peanuts and I would think that would give me some protein and some cheese. But then it got towards the end where I actually binge eat and drink and get myself sick. And then I ended up letting my mom talk me into coming here to California, and so she could help me. But I didn't know what kind of help I needed, and she realistically didn't know how to help me. She did tell me no drinking, partly because I didn't have any money. And she's like, you can't drink if you're going to live in my home. So I said, okay. So I just kind of, you know, after I did my steps, I realized I used my mother during that time. I didn't let her help me. I just let her, I used her to let me live in a home so I wouldn't be homeless. And I let her feed me. I let her give me a place to sleep. I let her let me use her water and her wash machine to keep clean clothes on my back. But at some point, my smart thinking was that I had the right to drink in my mother's house, and I brought some alcohol into the home. And then I protected it all night long against anybody else in the family that may have wanted to drink it, because didn't they know how hard it was for me to drink, you know, to bring this alcohol into this house. And I went out also and didn't, you know, stay at home very much either. I just went and found a bunch of new friends who would buy me some alcohol. I don't know who they are. They were just people. I called them friends, but they were just people I would go to in the bars. Oh, and also my other thing that I always convinced myself I didn't go to bars. It was forever before I realized I went to bars. And that was because I went to dance clubs. I was there to dance. I went to jazz clubs. I was there to listen to jazz. You know, I always went to sports bars because I was there to watch sports. So my brain really just kind of protected me against the concept, no, Catherine, you're going to these places to drink. And so it just kept me in the dark about how much drinking had taken over my life. My whole life was around, if I wasn't thinking about drinking, I was thinking about how am I going to get my next drink? When am I going to be able to drink? How am I going to fit this in my schedule? And that became my life. And I had crossed all my barriers pretty much on what I would be okay doing. The only reason I didn't cross the barrier of becoming and living homeless was because my mother was allowing me to live with her. And so in the end, basically what happened for me was that this way of thinking got to me to be so insane, and I didn't realize I was so insane, and I was so depressed, and I got so hopeless, and I was 29, and I was getting ready to turn 30, and I'm not quite sure who it was that said it to me, somebody in my family, you know. A lot of people say when they turn 30, they feel like they're getting old, and so this person in my family was just like wanting to tell me that, you're not getting old, you're 30, you've got a long life ahead of you, don't worry, you know, you got over half your life left. And in my head, that's supposed to be comforting, but for me what it did was it made me go, oh my gosh, I can't do another day. I can't live like this one more day. And it wasn't about the drinking for me, it was about how I was feeling and how empty inside I was and how much in depression that I was. And so my best thought was to try to commit suicide. Thank God it didn't work. I didn't even come close to having it be a plan that would actually work. But the motive was that I didn't want to wake up the next morning. And where that landed me was in a mental institution. And for about 10 years in sobriety, I kept telling people, you know that place in the book, jails, institution, and death? And I kept saying, I've never ended up in any of those places. And then one day I finally woke up and I was all like, oh my God, I was in a mental institution. I was like, yes, of course, I was institutionalized. I have met one of those. So it ended me up in the mental institution, and I still didn't get it. I came out of there with some guy on my arm like I do all the time, and I was going to go tackle the world, and I was so insane, and he had a court card, and I was complaining to him about my family, thinking that I had a problem. He's like, well, hey, come to me with this, to this AA meeting, and I'll, you know, we'll just, you can figure out from them. You can decide if you are. They'll let you know. And I thought he was like on a gym membership card. I didn't know what a court card was. I thought he was like a special member or something, and I had to go with him. So off we went to the Alano Club, and nobody there. You guys welcomed me. Nobody there told me that I didn't belong. Nobody there didn't tell me that I needed to go home, that I wasn't an alcoholic. And it just kind of pissed me off, because that's what my motive was to go into AA, was to find that person that's going to take one look at this 95-pound, sickly, insane woman and tell me that I wasn't an alcoholic and I could go home. And that didn't happen. So they just said, you know what, welcome, keep coming back. And I was like, I'll piss. I said, I'll show you, I'll come back. And I went back the next day, and I did this for I don't know how long it was, but I did it long enough to where God intervened. And you know, there's a member in our fellowship that talks about how he would say, I'm here for information only. I wasn't even there for you guys' information. I didn't want anything to do with you. And I walked out and I grabbed something, and that was my first God shot. I grabbed this pamphlet or this paper, and I went home out of the brochures. I went to my mom's house, and I was taking and it ended up being the test. And I was like, oh, great, I'm good test. I'm going to pass, and then I'll let everybody know I'm not an alcoholic. So I take this test, and my second God shot was that I actually answered the questions honestly. I don't know why, first time ever. And I'm answering these questions, and at the end, I passed. But what that meant was that I found out I was an alcoholic. And I just started bawling, and my mom heard me from the other room. I was crying so hard that she came back, and she was like, what's the matter? And I said, and I raised up my chest. I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm crying. And she's like, yes, I know. And she's all excited. And so the thing of it is that God led me exactly into the place where I needed to be. I just didn't know I needed to be there. First, I was really angry. So if you're angry to be in Alcoholics Anonymous or in a recovery home or to do anything with alcoholism, that's okay. It might be exactly where you need to be until you can find, until God can lead you to that place where you can hear or see or understand that maybe alcohol is a problem. You know, I heard somebody say early on in meetings, you know, if you can relate to anything I say, then you might want to consider you may be one of us. That kind of pissed me off because I could relate to everything people were saying. And I so desperately in the beginning did not want to be an alcoholic. And, you know, I don't feel that way today. Today I'm so grateful to know that I'm an alcoholic. I'm so grateful that I have a solution to life. I'm so grateful that what used to be my solution that gave me that ease and comfort that turned against me and turned me into this insane woman who couldn't take care of herself, who had lost all abilities to have any kind of dignity or self-respect or control over how she did her life, the thing I fought up so hard against to do and acknowledge that I was an alcoholic and that there was a different way has become, once I surrendered, and I admitted to my innermost self that I am powerless over alcohol and that I have this thing called a disease. And I can remember how relieved I felt when I heard about the disease, because I came into AA feeling like I was just the worst human being on the earth and that I was just this really bad person who couldn't figure out how to do it right and how to be this good person. And what I found out, and you guys let me know that what it is that I have a disease. And it's called alcoholism, and that I am powerless over that first drink, and I'm beyond any kind of concept of human aid that's going to get me sober, that it's going to take a power greater than myself, that's going to have to work with inside of me and provide that ease and comfort for me that alcohol used to produce, that's going to relieve that obsession, that's going to allow me to become that person in life that I have always wanted to be. I just didn't know how to do it. And I just didn't know how to go about doing it. And so for today, I get to be that woman that hopefully is a better person than I've ever been. I feel that I am. You know, that I'm able to... I looked up one time the manageability of life, because... You know, our second step is about, you know, or our first step has the second part of it about, you know, that our lives are unmanageable. So I decided to look up, well, what does the word manageable mean? If I'm unmanageable, what is it going to take to be manageable? And when I looked up that word, one of the definitions that I discovered that I absolutely love and I've hung on to is that the definition said, after due consideration. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, when I used to make decisions when I was out there drinking, or even before I was drinking, I was 11, I didn't give much due consideration to what I was doing with my life. I didn't give a whole lot of consideration. I just went and did what I needed to do to survive. I just went and did whatever I needed to do to get that next drink, or to have somebody help me feel better about myself, or just to figure out how to do life, because I didn't know how to do life. And, you know, I've learned through the steps and through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, through working hopefully as best I can within all three parts of that triangle. You know, we have the fellowship, we have the unity, and we have the service, and we have the recovery. The unity is the fellowship, the service is me working with others, and then the recovery section of that third triangle is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are found within the first 64 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And although the meetings and being of service is like a huge part of my recovery, it won't do me any good to do those areas if I never go into the recovery part, because the recovery part is what's returned me to sanity, because the recovery part is what's actually led me, because that's the purpose of the steps, is to lead me to find this God of my own understanding that's going to help me to lead a more manageable life, a less insane life, and allow those promises to come true. You know, today I have some peace of mind. Even in the midst of the storm, I have some peace of mind. I intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. And I can promise you, everything in life used to baffle me, especially relationships with other people. I couldn't do them. And, you know, through through the grace of God, I get to have almost 25 years of being sober. And I kind of view that me being sober 25 years, I just have today. You know, I get sobriety today. The big book talks about how, you know, we get a daily reprieve based on our spiritual condition. That means just today do I get a daily reprieve of my alcoholism. And so long as I'm willing to do each day what is needed for me to stay sober today, which means a sober mind, which means a sane mind, that ability to, after due consideration, make decisions about how my life is going to look. You know, if I'm able to do that every day, the only difference between me and the person that's walking new into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is that today I just have a few more experiences sober. You know, I've gone through a lot of my firsts, my first time sober doing things. I'm still teachable and I'm still learning those first time. You know, I've experienced a lot in sobriety over the last almost 25 years. You know, I've had jobs, no jobs. I've been married, divorced. I've been remarried. I have been with money, without money. I, you know, have lost a son, gained a son back. My son was in sobriety, then he wasn't in sobriety. And I was sick and then I was well. And, you know, there's just all of those things about life that still continues to happen. But, you know, if I believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I believe that this is what has been my solution for the majority of my adult life, that has led me to have relationships today, that has led me to be that better sister and that better friend and hopefully a better wife and hopefully a better employee. You know, if I'm able to do those things today without, you know, the use of alcohol, then I've won. You know, I've truly won in life because it's a miracle that I don't drink today, because in the end, I'm an alcoholic and I have the disease of alcoholism. And for me to be able to stay here sober and be able to come into an uncomfortable Zoom room and share, looking at myself on this monitor the entire time, which is freaking weird. You know, if I can do that, it's because I am just wanting to share whatever message, and if only one person hears it out there tonight, that doing the steps, finding recovery, and getting the life that you've always wanted can be found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to thank everybody for showing up to the Zoom meeting. There's a whole lot more than you than I expected, but I'm so grateful you're here, and thank you for letting me be of service tonight.
Awesome. Thank you, Catherine. Can we all give her a muted round of applause? All right, you did great. There we go. That's awesome. Thank you so much.